So we're now moving into the area of sort of legal interventions into bioethics, and particularly with regard to the United Nations and UNESCO. Dr. Chamundeswari Kupaswamy, did I get that right completely? Yeah, it's going to take us through some of the debate on human rights, specifically with regard to the human genome. Is that correct? Well, anyway, let me welcome you to the podium.
Well, it's the first time I'm sort of speaking at on this topic, and also perhaps to a audience which is so mixed. So I was really looking forward to it, and it's just great to see that all of you have come back after the break as well, so I think that's a good sign for me. Well, I'm not sure how to sort of think about, classify my talk topic today, because I think lawyers perhaps would not look at it as a legal talk, but perhaps artists would not look at it as an artistic talk, but I think there are going to be elements of all of that in the talk, and hopefully, you know, my thinking in all the, in this area will become clear when I go through the slides with you. my professional background is basically in law, and I was trained in international law and constitutional law, which in itself is quite different to some of the other areas of national law, details of which I won't go into. If you're familiar with a bit law, you might just want to keep this distinction in mind regarding the points I make. But I'm also an artist. I'm a trained dancer, and I've not professionally performed, although I've been trained to professional standards, so I think that's where my interest comes in as well. And I think you'll find a little bit more in the pack about how I came to the intersection between bioethics and arts, and I also coordinate a network, Arts and Bioethics Network, which is part of the International Association of Bioethics, which is a global group of scholars in bioethics coming from different disciplines, including philosophy, law, sociology, science communication. And at the last conference, we had artists too, which was, I'll talk a little bit about that during the talk. So a bit about policy. It's the law and the practice that surrounds it, which you could envisage as being policy. And there are lots of occasions when you don't have law in that area, but you probably have guidelines, which probably have a little bit less binding effect, but they also form policy. Now, guidelines, of course, give you a bit more flexibility about how you work, and particularly in the area of bio-law, regulating biotechnologies and new technologies, it could be a very, very useful tool to start off with. And law and policy is very much influenced by new technologies, both in the procedural sense, you know, how we use, for example, new internet digital technologies in the way in which we, conduct the whole legal process in terms of, you know, filing in forms online, etc., to regulating for these technologies as well. And I think it's the latter that I'm going to probably be concentrating today. So digital technology is one good example of how one of the areas which law actually struggles to cope with. In some ways, there's always the technology that's going ahead of the law in that area. And biotechnologies, particularly the Human Genome Project, is one of the areas where lots of legal issues have come out of, and policy issues. Now, firstly, I want to set up a position where I identify biopolicy as being a special case for policy making. And I think there are lots of reasons for this, and I'm going to try and explain that in the first part of my presentation. If I take you back a few years ago now, when the Warnock Committee reported on fertilization and embryology, the number of issues that they looked at, and one of the main issues where there was a lot of debate about was the status of the embryo as a research subject. You know, currently, it is settled law in many ways. And finally, they decided that it would be the 14-day limit that would be the cutoff point at which the embryo stops being a research subject. Now, the reason why that was taken as a limit, although if you look at the debates during the committee's work, was primarily based on scientific advice about the appearance of what they call the primitive streak. And in developmental biology, that is one of the landmarks of development of the embryo. So more or less, you could sort of conflate the two. The fact that embryo stops being a research subject is because that is a significant landmark in developmental biology. So the point of view here is that science had a lot to contribute towards the decision that came about. And the 14-day limit is primarily based on this sort of view that was expressed by developmental biologists that it is a significant point when you could. But then again, is that when life actually starts is a totally different question. But however, you could say that this kind of uncertainty, if you like, of course, in science, it wouldn't be looked at as uncertainty. That is just how the process is. You discover that this is what happens, this goes. But then in law, the body itself, Warnock Committee, Mary Warnock, who headed the committee, was a philosopher. And when they looked at how to fix, at what point do they actually look at the embryo as being subject of research, but then at what point it has to stop? They looked at the position in science, and that became fixed in the law, if you like. So one of the features is that there is uncertainty in science. Now that's, again, coming from a policy perspective, but from a science perspective, obviously that is about posing a question, discovering the answer to the question, and going on from there. But in this case, when it gets fixed in law, you look at a position in science trying to provide the best possible answer according to the policymakers, getting fixed in policy. So it's one of the features of biopolicy. There is a lot of uncertainty within how to answer certain questions, but then it has to be fixed one way or the other in law. This is at the moment going on in areas of policy making when it comes to issues about genetic engineering coming out of the Human Genome Project, and currently embryo research and cloning as well, other thriving areas of biopolicy. Now, the second reason why I think biopolicy is also a special case for policy making is because of the way in which the legislature decides on the law and policy in this area. The previous example I gave you was how science played an important role in establishing the sort of cutoff date for the embryo to stop being a research subject. Now, the other side of decision making is also the role of ethics, and it's very much exemplified by the conscience vote that recently took place in the Parliament as well. In the context of the amendments to the 1990 legislation, which is the Human Fertilization and Embryology Bill. So it's passed through the House of Lords and it's passed through the House of Commons as well, and I think it's going to become law probably in 2009. And if you look at the voting pattern, I'll just pick one example. One of the important issues that came up, one of the important issues for which the amendments was actually passed was the issue of cybrid embryos. Or there were two cases discussed in the House of Commons and in the bill itself. And one of them was the creation of true hybrids, in the sense actually mixing the nucleus from animals and humans. And then the other case was using the nucleus of the of humans, but with the shell of an animal cell. So the cybrid embryo is not actually a true hybrid, but it's completely the human nucleus, but just the shell of the animal egg. So that was passed with a majority of 336 to 176. So you could see that these are very, very contentious issues. And the voting, of course, was not on parliamentary party lines, but it was more based on individual ethical well, individual decision, I suppose. And one of the things that comes out in the debate is that ethics played a huge role in the way in which the parliamentarians decided which way they were going to go. And you can see that it's still very, very contentious. There was a recent legal challenge to some of the licenses granted by the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority as on April the 8th, 2008. And this was on the basis that the HFVA, as it was before the amendment, was really not authorized to grant licenses for cybered embryos, because the license was granted sometime in January and the amendments were only being passed through the House of Lords at that time. So this is still yet to be decided. So, you know, it's the point I want to sort of highlight over here is what kind of input there is into policy making. We've already looked at the Warnock report and the amount of input science and scientists had in that occasion. And then I've taken the example of the conscience vote to look at the other, if you like, view that comes in when making policy in this area, which is ethics, you know. And then I'm also looking at, are there any other stakeholders, other stakeholding points of view? We've got the science there, we've got the ethics there. What about the rest? Thirdly, I think biopolicy is again a special case of policy making, because biopolicy cannot just be created within a particular national jurisdiction, mainly because of the concept that, you know, biological heritage is a common heritage which belongs to not just people within a particular legal jurisdiction, but within, you know, a number of international countries in the world. So biopolicy is essentially global, now, which means we are looking at a diversity of views. I mean, not just diversity of views in terms of particular cultures, but I think, you know, and that's one of the main reasons why you get international organizations working on it in this, you know, in the current situation. I've given you some examples of UNESCO and HRC's, the Human Rights Committee, which is part of the United Nations General Assembly, and then the European Community. So we've got layers of policy making, and then it's very interesting to see what influences the already sort of two aspects I've talked about, science and ethics, have on debates in these different layers. At the national level, depending on which country it is, you see science sort of going up there and then ethics going up. There's always this sort of, you know, balance going on. And when it throws, you know, comes out in the into the you know, global policymaking arena, I think that sort of opens out itself to a number of diverse views. And certainly there is a need for harmonization over here. You know, already take an example of, you know, going out for assisted suicide into Switzerland. You can think of so many other different examples where you can see that it would be ethically and intellectually incoherent to have different frameworks for something that we consider to be the common heritage. You know? So these are some of the reasons why I think biopolicy is a special case. And not just science, not just ethics, but there must be a role at a much more fundamental, you know, opening out to other views, and I'll explain that. So what exactly is the role of policy? The key feature, I think, is that it regulates behavior and action. And one of the phenomena that you do find while making biopolicy is that there's a tendency to think about what is the scientific truth in relation to this particular question. And somehow the policymakers, if you look at the debates, if you look at some of the end results we've achieved in particular jurisdictions, it seems to validate scientific truth, almost conflate that, give a lot of, you know, almost disproportionate sometimes importance to some of these. So I think that's one of the key things. Because if you want to regulate behavior and action, what is it that actually makes us act and behave the way we do? So that's really where we need to go to, rather than looking at what is the science in this particular field and how do we actually... We could use that as one of the main factors, but what kind of importance do we actually give? Is it too much? But of course, within the UK, we've seen the public engagement through consultations and public polls do play a very important role in policy making. And I think the key in that is the whole idea of engagement, you know. What and how, you know, does this engagement look like? And is intellectual, emotional. But if you look at behavior, I think intellectual, emotional, I'm putting this very simplistically because I'm aware I have to cover a breadth of issues over here, but I think you understand the sense I'm trying to get across to you when I say intellectual and emotional. But behavior, as we know, is equally shaped by, intellectual input as well as emotional. So how do we actually get all this into the engagement, process? So arts and engagement, then. I think one of the key things is about awareness. As I was listening to the first two speakers, I sort of had lots of ideas that could actually fit in over here, and I think you would have made those connections as well in terms of how it engages and how it's opens up, etc. So I'd probably, ask you to have that in the back of your mind while I'm talking about things. I'm giving a couple of examples here. So engagement at various levels, and one example I think we've had a lot of projects like this in the UK is engagement with young people. Welcome Trust programs, I'm sure many of you are involved in it or aware of it. The Biomedical Science and Arts, it's a particular stream which funds engagement in arts and bioethics for young people. One example, I mentioned the International Association of Bioethics and the World Congress, and this is one of the arts engagement projects that was showcased at our session at the World Congress of Bioethics. And this was actually a theatre company working with a group of young people to develop the storyline, and that was developed collaboratively. And it was it brought the modern and the sort of ancient myth together as well. And I think that was again those two strands came from the young people as well. And it was about Xavier siblings and stem cell research. Now, one of the key observations that came out from this whole process was that the engagement was very sustained, and it was also contextual. So that was seen as being very important, that they could not get that from a direct science class or from a direct ethics class. So, and the other key thing was that it increased awareness in a very real way by the complexities of the issues that were involved, Xavier siblings and stem cell research, etc. And also, one of the things the young people came out with was they understand what goes into the management of all this. So I think it was a package that all came together, and a good example of how awareness can be created with art and engagement. Now the other thing we also did at the World Congress of Bioethics was about arts and bioethics, but engaging academics in the process of knowledge formation. So how could artistic explorations into bioethics actually push the limits of interdisciplinary research into sort of really unprecedented extents? And we had two events. One was an arts bioethics exhibition, very much like what we've got here. It was the Art of Bioethics 1, and this is the Art of Bioethics 2. And we also had the arts bioethics performance session, where we had poetry, we had dance, we had drama. So, different, being very aware that the arts is, of course, a very, very wide breadth, we tried to bring in all of the experiences together. So all through the conference, you had people experiencing art and bioethics in a particular way, and then also having an academic debate in the regular way of, papers, etc. One of the observations that came out from that was by Professor Raymond Gaither, who's from King's College and also Australian Catholic College. And according to him, he thought ethical thinking, ethical analysis at the moment is very much preoccupied with, the principles of conduct, what they are, how can they be rationally justified, etc. We give ourselves very, very less space to actually reflect on the meaning of all this and how it actually fits into the human condition. So I think that, just wanted to put that remark in. And there was another talk as well about ethical analysis and being ethical. And I was reminded of one of my favorite authors, Henry Thoreau, about professors of philosophy not really being philosophers, but then where do we have the philosophers? I suppose arts is one of the ways in which you could get that link between the human condition and the rational analysis that we actually do. And I've been thinking about it ever since as well. And picking up journal articles or books, you find bits of verse, you find lots of pictures. And in fact, we also have poster sessions now, which are integral parts of academic conferences. So academic writing and research also has, I suppose, bits and pieces of art embedded in it. But how exactly does that affect the discussion of the issue? You know, for example, there's an article on a particular issue with more use of verse here and there, opposed to another article. Does that have a different effect? And I think there are, you know, being an international lawyer, there's a lot of aspiration setting function for the arts in terms of, you know, Parliament of the Man, and then you're looking at how the United Nations perhaps should really function that way. But, you know, do we really want it to, given the political the situations that we have, and given the fact that we might not come to any decision at all? But again, you need that because you are moving towards something. You set a goal. Thank you. And arts and engagement in terms of, so far I was looking at arts and how it could contribute towards, you know, bioethics in terms of engaging people in different ways in terms of knowledge formation. I also wanted to look at how policy, and particularly law, you know, because that's my field, is quite attached to written and spoken words, and to some extent graphics. But I want to give you some examples of how it actually does not serve some of the purposes that, you know, we would want it to serve in society. I want to take an example from intellectual property law, because that's one of the areas I teach, and the protection of trademark. And in a recent case, the Siegmund case decided in the European courts, it was about the registration of smell as trademark, and you can see the balsamically fruity smell with a slight hint of cinnamon was what the trademark was requested for. But it was denied because there's a requirement in the law that smell cannot be represented graphically, but then if you want to register a trademark, you have to represent something graphically. And it's actually strange to say, well, you know, how could you actually look at one sense and then convert it to another sort of sense? But you could see that the response from the legal side here was, you know, did not really stretch. Now, the point to make over here is that it's possible to have a smell as a trademark, but it's not possible to register it, therefore you can't actually have it. So you can see that there is this sort of resistance of, you know, it has to be either in writing, well, at the maximum it can be, you know, it should be represented graphically, but how do you do that? So this is just one example of how, you know, from the policy side, there are lots of different constraints and not particularly suitable in an audiovisual, you know, multi-sensory world that we are in currently. And the reason why we have this is because you require legal certainty. That's one of the key reasons that the court stated. Of course, legal certainty is a cherished value because, you know, you need to know where you stand, especially when you're going to be, you know, faced by arguments in a court of law. But the fact that written down law is what can actually bring that certainty is the thing that needs to be questioned. Yeah. But if that is the certainty you're actually looking for, then you're actually excluding some of the needs of society. For example, you know, this particular business saw that it required that trademark, but it couldn't do it. So what kind of certainty are we looking for? Now, quickly moving on to a little bit of legal history. This particular article was written in 1992 about legal values in performance cultures. And I found it interesting because the findings from that particular research and in that article seem to be very interesting in the context of, you know, different ways of knowing and telling that we are currently going through in the audiovisual society. And he talks about how legal expression and performance cultures have all these different characteristics that I've listed here in terms of being socially sensitive, socially persuasive, being open textured, dynamic. I'd like to actually go into this a little bit more, but because of lack of time, I think I'll, you know, leave you to... Right, a performance culture, for example, a contract. Nowadays, we write it down. So we've got the terms and conditions written down, fixed, sealed, signed, witness, etc. In a performance culture, a contract will actually be performed. So the terms and conditions of the contract will actually be performed in a relational sense. And that's actually a very, very interesting article, which I've given a reference to at the end of my slide, and you could go back and have a look at it. I mean, could give a whole talk on that. I think I give you an idea of what sort of meant in performance. So it's not written down, but it's acted out in those cultures. Now, so final reference to how the certainty aspect in law actually has moved away quite a bit. And currently, I've taken just one example of another area of law, which is the Civil Procedure Code, which after, there was a lot of soul searching going on in the end of 90s, and there was finally a report in 1997 by Lord Wolfe, which was called the Access to Justice Report. And one of the main findings there was that the key overall principle of our civil justice system should be that it should be just and convenient, full stop. So essentially, here you're looking at not legal certainty, but your main aim here is being just and convenient. And the existing principles of equity, of custom, etc., that we have, also, I think, if developed and used in biopolicy in a way that we could actually get in this kind of flexibility, get in certainty, but at the same time leave it flexible. And at the same time, leave a possibility of interpretation of all these different policies, not just within the narrow spectrum of legislators and interpreters, as in the courts, but also the public by way of public engagement. I think I'll quickly finish by moving back into the arts. Just wanted to give you one example of how all of my thinking on the sort of biopolicy and different aspects I've talked about come together when I think about or engage with some of the bioethics issues. And this particular example is a production that I did along with my sister, who's also in the audience, and I can talk to you about the sort of dance aspects of it if anybody's interested in it, how it contributed to, you know, formation of some new mudras, hand gestures in this particular form of dance. But one of the key things that came about from my involvement of producing this dance was I'd always thought about issues within reproductive cloning in a very much rational way of what should be done and how it should be done. But in this, what actually came into focus for me was I was putting myself in the shoes of, you know, a clone. And that actually gave me a new focus to what issues should actually be on the top for ethical deliberation, and then, you know, it sort of gave me the hierarchy, which sort of didn't happen when I was looking at it from a, you know, non-performance aspect. So finally, concluding, I try to set out by saying that, you know, bioethics is really a special case of policy making, and engagement of science and ethics is already there, but there are other forms of engagement that we need. And I think there's a prejudice within law and policy towards the written and spoken word, which actually neglects some of the values that we have in interpreting law as, you know, it was interpreted within performance cultures. And perhaps we could bring that in some different ways. I have a few ideas for that, but no time to probably go into that, maybe in the reception. And I think... Sure. And what we are... I'm hoping, yes. So finally, what are we actually trying to get through biopolicy? We're looking for robust, clear, and also globally accepted biopolicy, because it is very difficult, particularly in a very real way, you know, after the European Union was formed and after the UK joined the European Union, the laws in the UK have been affected by the European Union, and then we can see how, you know, how it is also a moral imperative that we have to have policy that is much more coherent, not just here, but in other parts of the world as well, and to harmonize all this. So I think I'll stop with that.